Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. And I'm excited today to have Kennedy Hall with us today. Kennedy Hall is an author from Ontario, Canada. He works with the Fatima Center and has a weekly show called The Kennedy Report on the Fatima Center YouTube channel. I'm having a hard time this morning pronouncing things. He has taught high school for years and has authored two books, Terror of Demons, Reclaiming Traditional Catholic Masculinity, and a fictional book called Family Be Damned. Both are available at kennedyhall.ca. And they're both very good books. I highly recommend them. He is also the editor of the upcoming magazine entitled The Catholic Home. Visit thecatholichome.ca for more about this. And most importantly, for the purposes of this podcast, Kennedy and his family attend a church that is run by the Society of St. Pius X. And so my first question to you is, why are you a schismatic, Kennedy?
I'm so rad that I just wanted to trad myself out of the church, basically. Right.
Exactly. But seriously, we want to talk about SSPX today. Obviously, in the Catholic world, it's a often topic of discussion. It's very controversial, obviously, which is a weasel word. I know controversial is. But at the same time, anytime SSPX or Archbishop Lefebvre is mentioned, it typically generates a lot of debate, a lot of discussion among Catholics. And so what I wanted to do today, I want to talk a little bit about, on a high level, the SSPX, its standing in the church, is it in schism, things like that, but also your experience as an actual member of a SSPX-run chapel. And sure. Actually, I'll even first mention, you are not a member of the Society of St. Pius X. People often say that. Only a priest, correct me if I'm wrong, only a priest. Yes. And are there religious nuns also?
Yeah. Okay. There's so nuns. They have two types of nuns. One are basically more contemplative. One serve the priests and the mission stuff. And then I forget their names. One, I believe, was a Dominican order that was sort of absorbed.
Okay.
And then there's brothers, religious brothers.
Okay. And I think it comes from the official name. It's the priestly fraternity, right? Yes. Isn't that part of the name? Yes. So anyway, you're not a priest, so you can't be an actual member. No. But the point is you attend a SSPX chapel, which is what we're talking about today. So First, let's just ask the question, why do you attend an SSPX chapel?
Like you, I've got a similar background. I was not a convert, but I was a revert. I'm 33 years old. So I've been practicing the faith seriously since I was about 25, 26. And right around the time that my wife was pregnant with our first child, who's about 5.5 years old right now, my oldest of four, I just started taking the faith really seriously. I went to Guadalupe and that was a whole thing. I've written about that in articles at Crisis. And came back on fire. And at that time, I was just a nominal Catholic. I had no liturgical understanding. I was just a guy who grew up in sort of lukewarm Catholic schools, Italian immigrant mother. So I'm just Catholic. It's just kind of who I am and whatever that means. When I found the faith and started to believe the faith and all that sort of stuff, then I started to take things seriously. So I became what I would call, and I don't mean this in any denigrating way, I became a Catholic Answers Catholic. You know, I listened to the Catholic Answers live for like 400 days in a row, you know, and it was amazing. I mean, I learned everything. Yeah. About, you know, one thing that channel does really well is they do a lot of things really well. But one of the things they do really well is hammer home the basics about the creed. You know, you will know the basics of the faith if you listen to that channel. So that was wonderful. But then as certain things in my life happen, my no, God rest his soul, was dying. And he's of that World War II generation. And I speak Italian. It's a very important part of my life. And as he was dying, I kind of had this idea that, okay. And I really started to look into how he grew up, and that became important to me. And then I started to realize kind of implicitly that I don't know if my Catholicism looks like his Catholicism looked, because he was about 40 something years old when the mass changed. And so just that made me look into other things. And I found Sensus Fidelium on YouTube, which is trad-pilled many, many a Catholics, I guess you could say, on the internet. And they're not even society priests, but they're just traditional priests. And I learned, like, I listened to Father Ripperger and all those guys, like, for months, you know, just like complete inundation of all these traditional sermons. And I realized, man, I want this. And I just want to go find this. So Google does not distinguish between, well, I'm tongue in cheek here. They don't distinguish between in communion and partial or, you know, partial communion, full communion. So I looked up Latin Mass near me on Google Maps. 20 minutes down the road is a Society Chapel. And that's what Google told me. I didn't know what it was. Looked into it. I realized it was controversial. Really did my homework. And eventually we decided to make that our chapel. So that's kind of how we ended up there. It was just from a search for tradition, really.
Now, were there any other, after you found that one, did you discover, are there any other traditional Catholic parishes as FSPS, anything like that in the area? Yeah.
There is a Latin Mass community in about an hour from me. And I went there, we went there for about a year. We have, maybe some people will watch this that are friends of mine. We have a lot of wonderful friends who worried about losing friends. When we went, you know, we didn't want to go too trad because we have four small children. Our families do not practice the faith. So our support network in this growing family is largely people from church, which is wonderful. And we didn't want to offend anybody, really. So we decided to make the longer drive to that Latin Mass community for about a year. But then my kids are getting older. I mean, they've grown so much in the last couple of years. I went from having four kids under 4 years old to now I've got kids who are talking and writing and stuff, you know, and it's a quick transition. And I thought to myself, okay, we need, not that I'm not grateful that there was a Mass every Sunday at 3 p.m. every Sunday, you could go to Mass an hour away from my house. And if that was all we had, I would be still going there. But I wanted a real parish life for my family. The chapel near us is Mass. I mean, when we're not under lockdown persecution, it's Mass every day. It's 2 to 3 Masses every Sunday, high Masses, low Masses, feast days, catechism, youth group. They have a school. I mean, it's kind of like St. Mary's, Kansas, but in Canada. Weirdly enough, I've kind of hit the jackpot in that sense. So I had to go there. Providentially, that Latin Mass community, and they've basically been suppressed since Corona. Since the lockdowns, which seems like what's happening a lot of places. So for us, I mean, it was the right move.
Now, I know a lot of people, and I think I would probably include myself in this group, would still be hesitant to go to an SSPX parish because of what you kind of jokingly referred to before, the whole issue of, is the SSPX in communion with the Catholic Church? Is it in partial communion? Is it in like kind? Is it partially pregnant, for example, or something? You know, it's like, is it out of communion? I mean, you'll hear the whole range where some people will say, "Oh no, it's in full communion." Others will say it's in partial communion. Some will say it's out of communion. It's actually officially schismatic. Mm-hmm. And so, how do you overcome that? Because I would think, at least in my mind, that would really play on the back of my mind. Like, okay, if I'm going to play it safe. Yeah, maybe I'll go to the 3 o'clock once a week. I get your point about like one's got parish life and one just doesn't really. Not that your family can really enter into. But yet still in the back of your mind, does it ever crop up like, okay, you know, how do you resolve, I guess, in your own mind of, you know, the communion question?
It took me about a year and a half to really figure that out, to be honest. I was convinced, listen, there's a body of literature. I would recommend an article by Peter Kwasniewski at 1 Peter 5. Father Z has a wonderful article, and perhaps I'll send you something that you can put in the show notes.
Yeah, sure.
It's I'll send things. There are people that are smarter than me who have done the research, okay? So I knew right away that it was canonically fine to go to a Mass. I mean, you can read things from Rome where it literally says it is not a sin. It fulfills Sunday obligation. Okay. So if you know your ecclesiological terms a little bit, I mean, if something's not a sin, what means it's not bad. And if it's not bad, then it's either neutral or good. So going to the Mass is good. So if it's not sinful, it's good. I mean, it's kind of simple that way. That being said, if you're going to hang your hat on something, you want to make sure that you're good all the way through. So to be honest, in the beginning, one of the reasons why we didn't commit right away, even though I knew we could, and we went to that other community for about a year, was because I didn't want to use the SSPX as a placeholder. Sometimes people will say, well, you can go there if there's no other options. I mean, yes, technically that's the case, but I actually don't really like that line of thinking, because to me, it's like, well, something's wrong about it, so just go do the thing that's kind of wrong if you really need to. I know that's not what it means as far as the validity of sacraments, but for me, as trying to make a parish for my family, I was like, no, I'm only going to go if it's good all the way through, if I can justify that to myself. So basically, I just did a lot of research, and I ended up reading this biography, and this is Marcel Lefebvre's biography. It's astonishing how many people I've spoken to, clerics, vicars of diocese, lay people, a lot of people, who have a lot of opinions about the society, and they haven't really done much research about it. And they have a saint. I believe he was a saintly man. And I believe there's precedent in church history for men like him, St. Athanasius, St. Eusebius, who ordained priests and consecrated bishops without jurisdiction in the Arian crisis. St. Vincent Lawrence, another bishop in the 1200s from England, I can't remember his name. Men who were in extraordinary situations, followed their formed holy conscience as best as they possibly could in the truest sense of a formed conscience, made decisions that were controversial, but were an instrument of preserving the faith in their region, if that makes sense. Lefebvre is just kind of an example of that in the modern media world. So I was convinced of his sanctity. And then, funny enough, in a sad way, when I was considering the SSPX, that's when the McCarrick stuff all came out. So all of a sudden, it was not politically incorrect to talk about that maybe there are problems in Kansas. Maybe Houston, we have a problem. So then it was like people were really easy to say, well, a state of necessity. That doesn't sound too crazy anymore. So that's kind of where I got. But I'm sure there's more that there is to talk about that. But that's for me.
Yeah, I've read that book as well. It's an excellent book just to understand the man, Archbishop Lefebvre. And it's funny because in reading it, I came out of it where I definitely thought that, I didn't agree with him on a number of things. And I think his actions, the consecrations, and even I think a lot of his, in my opinion, a lot of his papal theology, I'm not sure if it stands under the weight of people like a Pope Francis or something like that. But ultimately, what I saw was this was a man who cared very much for the salvation of souls. I mean, that has to be indisputable. And everything he did, right or wrong, whether you agree with it or not, he clearly did, not as look at me, follow me, I want to form this sect, I want to form this cult around me or anything like that. He's like, no, I want to save souls. And I think this is the best way to save souls. So I mean, I think that is an important point to note with him. Now, what are the common arguments? I've already mentioned one about being out of communion, things like that. Oh, actually, let's go back to that for a second.
Sure.
How would you describe the communion status, so to speak, of the Society of Saint Pius X?
Well, they're in communion because they're not excommunioned. So if you're not excommed, you're incom. It's kind of, it really is that simple. Now, the reality is, though, and I want to give as much benefit of the doubt as possible. I don't want to come off as one of those guys who's just flippant about Vatican II or anything for no reason. There was an attempt within the framework of the Second Vatican Council to try and speak about the Orthodox and the Protestants in a very nuanced way. Whatever the intention of that may have been, I don't know. I'm just saying that's kind of what we see. So it is a mystery in some ways when you talk about the Orthodox, because you and I actually, I know we've talked about it a little bit. I'm in agreement with you on the Orthodox. I'm kind of softer on them than a lot of traditional Catholics, ironically, from one of the things that my SSPX pastor told me. But Soloviev, the Russian author, he talks about this. Basically, if you have valid sacraments and you believe the dogmas and you don't willingly disagree or separate yourself from something that is a saving truth, whether you're in or out is kind of going to be an individual judgment. And that's not something that I can know and impute on you. So that was how the church was trying to talk about the Orthodox. So these terms of partial communion or imperfect communion or not full communion, I think they were a failed attempt to try to talk about what is a complicated reality. And when it came to the SSPX, people started using these terms. Well, they're not in full communion. The problem is no one has ever defined what full communion means. I mean, if you pray for the Pope, if you're not excommunicated, if you believe all the dogmas of the faith and you pledge allegiance to the Pope, you may not agree with him on everything, but he's the Pope and he holds the office. I mean, you're a Roman Catholic. So as far as them being in communion specifically, Pope Francis, and you can find this at Catholic Culture, that website, which I think the Lawlers run, don't they, or something?
I think Phil is involved with that. Yeah, I think he runs it.
And Pope Francis gave the SSPX universal jurisdiction to ordain priests in any diocese. So I don't know if the Pope gave priests not in communion, then we have a state of necessity, which ironically proves the position of the society, or they're just Catholic priests. Now, they do have a canonically irregular situation, and they will admit that. To be honest, you're a baseball fan. I kind of look at they're like free agents. They're in the league.
Right.
They're registered baseball players. They just, no one wants to put them on their team officially. So they just kind of go play somewhere else. Right. And so they're there to offer sacraments. Now, they also take great care in ensuring that they don't cross non-negotiable lines. So they call it a chapel instead of calling it a parish. We say parish colloquially, but a parish is a jurisdiction, that meaning a geographical area. They don't say they have that and have never pretended to. The bishops were consecrated as auxiliaries without any diocese. And they just take care to make sure they don't cross those lines. But for example, I have a friend who's discerning the priesthood. Maybe he'll watch. He's a young man. He's a convert from Anglicanism. And he came into the church about a year ago. Anyway, he thinks he has a vocation. So he goes to our chapel and he's talking to the priests. And they said, hold on, we have to write Rome first to find out which rite you should be ordained into. We think it's the Latin rite. But anyway, the point is the society does that all the time. So when they have a priest candidate, they write to Rome and Rome writes back about, so they're in the church, whatever that means. Everything else is kind of just politics. And that's above my pay grade.
Right. Now, real quick, I want to take a step back in case there's people listening, watching this that don't understand this. The SSPX accepts Francis as the Pope, correct?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah,
okay. I just want to make sure that everybody who's listening knows this. It's not a situation of Sede Vacantinus who would reject not Francis as the valid Pope. And there's actually a splinter group off of the SSPX from years ago, SSPV, the Society of St. Pius V, that is agnostic, I think, officially about who the Pope is. Yep. And then there's, of course, independent chapel, stuff like that. So just to be clear for everybody who's listening to this, the SSPX does accept Francis as their Pope. For example, if you go into, and I just want to be clear here, I've never entered an SSPX chapel. I've never even personally met a priest or even in person met somebody who goes to SSPX. Well, maybe I haven't, I didn't know it, but
we look like if you walk, people.
What's that?
We look like normal people.
That's right. I know you actually have, you know, two eyes and ears and everything, just like normal people. You're not aliens. But if you walk into an SSPX chapel, will you see a picture of Pope Francis?
Yeah, it's somewhere. I mean, it depends on the place, but I think ours is in the church hall or something.
Right. Okay. So yeah. I just want to make sure I assumed that and I knew that, but I just want to make sure everybody else knew that. So what is the experience like for, just attending an SSPX chapel, how is it since you've now real quick, did you attend Novus Ordo Parish very long, or is that what you grew up in, correct? Okay.
Yeah.
So how is it differ from just your regular ordinary form parish versus the traditional Latin community you went to for a year? How does it compare to those two different entities?
Well, compared to the Novus Ordo, it's the same stark contrast of what you find in any traditional parish. I've only been to the Fraternity of St. Peter once when we were on vacation in Niagara Falls area. That's back when vacations existed in Canada. That was way different than the Novus Ordo. And as far as we going to the Latin Mass community that we used to go to, that was very traditional. It was actually in a beautiful old German church that still had the high altar and stuff. And the city had designated it as like a historical landmark. So they actually couldn't take things out, which was nice.
Awesome.
And that was great. I mean, you know, veils and rosaries and statues and incense and all that. It's just traditional Catholicism. So if you walk into the chapel before mass, people are praying rosaries. People are going to confession. You know, people are reading their missals. I mean, it's just Catholicism. A lot of babies in the crying room. That's where I spend a lot of time with my children. And And then as far as parish life, it's a full-fledged everything. So, you know, catechism, Eucharistic crusade, which was, I think Fulton Sheen started that. I'm not sure. Where it's like two or three times. This is when we were allowed to do this stuff. Right, We've had it off and on because of the lockdown things. But, you know, like catechism for kids, catechism for adults, doctrinal classes for adults on the weekdays. There's a class called The Pope Speaks, where basically they go over encyclicals of the popes. Usually an older one, like a sort of really great encyclical, but just about the kingship of Christ and things. That's it. It's just Catholicism. Yeah.
So a typical homily that you would hear, how often would you say, is it talking about, for example, the crisis in the church? Is it talking about Pope Francis? I mean, I've heard different things. And obviously your experience is just going to be your chapel. It's not going to be necessarily worldwide or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But how often do they talk about like the situation of the SSPX? I mean, is that brought up in homilies and the relationship with Pope Francis and things like that?
Very rarely. Actually, the homily, but it was like a fire-breathing homily, problems in the church. And it was really strong. I was actually like, well, I hope your bishop doesn't hear this. Although the bishop in that diocese is pretty good, hence why he invites the fraternity in. But no, I mean, I've only heard our priests talk about, and we've had, since I've been there, three priests on average always there, and then a visiting priest. So I've heard seven or eight different priests preach at our chapel. And I've only ever heard them talk about the Pope in like a hypothetical sense. So, you know, just kind of making an example about, you know, the magisterium or something. And then when we, one of the Petrine feast days, because our chapel is called St. Peter. Okay. And we're so schismatic that we even have pictures of the keys of Peter over top. So, you know, that anyway. on that day, they actually found a quote from Pope Francis they thought was pretty good and used it to preach about, and then said, we should pray for the Holy Father because we would like him to add a little more oomph to it and be more clear. It was quite charitable. I mean, that's kind of the, in a way, like the stuff that a lot of traditionalists are going through now, these old war dogs and the SSPX, they went through those in like the 70s, 80s, 90s. And they all have, we kind of joke, they'll say they have post-PVSD, post-Vatican II stress disorder. You know, like they've almost got like a PTSD of, they've been through the ringer for so long that they're just almost post-church politics. It's like, I'm just trying to be Catholic. I'm just trying to get my kids to heaven. And Rome has its problems. I'm just going to pray my rosary and live in a state of grace. And that's kind of the mentality of most people. Parishioners will be like anywhere else. I used to, at the one Latin Mass community, there was some interesting people there, because going to the traditional Mass is countercultural. So you find a variety of personalities. But as far as the clergy, they're just holy Catholic priests, and they don't really concern themselves too much with politics.
How many priests are stationed at your chapel?
Three.
Okay. That's how it's different from a lot of, in most places these days, it's ordinary form parishes. It's three parishes for one priest instead of the other way around.
We have a school too.
Oh, you do have a school.
That's why they're also teachers.
Yeah. Well, how, what grades is
K through 12.
K through 12. Okay.
But K through six is co-ed, very small classes at the actual church, and it's actually an old Lutheran church they bought. And then, 7 through 12 is a boys boarding school.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Very good. Now let's take it back a high level for a minute. Archbishop Lefebvre, the founder of the Society of St. Pius X, he's obviously, to use the word again, controversial. And I think, again, I would recommend, hold up the book again. I recommend that book. It's obviously a pro Lefebvre book, but I think it's well-written. And it explains his life and explains from his point of view how he saw things. And I think that's important to see. But ultimately, the question almost always comes down to the consecration, the episcopal consecration. Sure. For those who aren't aware of the scenario, in 1988, Archbishop Lefebvre ordained he consecrated four men to the episcopacy. He made them bishops, in other words. And this was done in violation, I don't know what the word would be, but against the express wishes of John Paul II. John Paul II, Lefebvre for years had worked with the Vatican trying to get approval for this. He worked actually directly with Cardinal Ratzinger, the head of the Congregation for Doctrine and Faith Time, obviously later become Pope Benedict XVI. And as I understand it, and if I get any of these details wrong, we'll talk about what it means in a second. But if I get any details wrong, let me know. My understanding is that the Vatican was saying, yes, we're going to allow it at some point soon. And eventually, Archbishop Lefebvre, reaching an older age, I think he felt that he needed this to continue the society. He felt the society was still needed and to continue it. And so he went ahead and did it. And after doing it, now here's where things I know get controversial. John Paul II excommunicated, I mean, he declared, you know, Lefebvre and the four men who were consecrated bishops. And that essentially gives the, and Archbishop Lefebvre died, I think 4 years later, I think in 1992. Three. Yeah, okay. 4 years later. And he had not been officially reconciled to the church. Now, years later, Pope Benedict did lift the excommunications of the four men. So in the eyes of the Catholic Church in a general sense, and most Catholics would say, Archbishop Lefebvre died an excommunicant. So now that I've explained kind of how it, the details of what happened, how would you as an SSPX going person kind of defend his actions, but also explain why? I think some people, some SSPX, I think you say he's not really technically excommunicated, but anyway, explain all that and how you view it.
Sure. I want to make sure I get all the details correct.
Yeah, please do.
Okay. So essentially, Lefebvre started the society in a totally legit manner, all the channels, you know, signed off on all these things in the diocese that he started in. Eventually, the controversy came up that he wouldn't say the new mass. Contrary to what people believe, he actually wasn't against liturgical reform. He said the so-called Vatican II mass for a little while, where he would face the people at certain prayers instead, say certain things in the vernacular and take out certain prayers. That was sort of the recommendations that was kind of going wrong in the French circles. But when the new mass was officially put in, he was, like with Cardinal Ottaviani and various people, just very worried about the Protestant spirit. 50 years later, we kind of see what we see, and the writing's on the wall about how that worked out. Now, found himself in some controversy because, actually, you have to go back even further. The first controversy arose in the mid-1970s when basically his term with this new society, Society of Apostolic Life, which is the Society of St. Paul, that's their official sort of canonical term. Basically, they were told you can't continue because you're not going to accept the new mass. Problem is, the church operates on a legal structure. We have a juridical process. So it's not enough to just declare something. I mean, there's this big controversy going on in the United States with a man who was just found guilty of murder and things. We don't need to get into that. But the point is, you can say things and you can say it from the highest courts in the land, but you still have to follow the juridical process. You still have to have a trial. That's what it means to have a juridical process. That just never took place with Lefebvre. And Cardinal Vilo was a man who turned out to be one of those kind of bad actors, unfortunately, suspect around the death of John Paul I, etc. He basically told the congregation in charge of hearing these things just not to hear it. And Lefebvre was left in a legal limbo. So they just carried on. And eventually it came to the point in 1988 where he made the decision to go through the consecrations. The reason he made that decision, he rejected the idea of doing that for a long time because he was gravely worried about being separated from the church for good reason. Now, what's interesting, this book, it is definitely pro Lefebvre, but when you read about the lead up to the consecrations, you get a little nervous because... Lefebvre at one point was like, there's no way I'm going to do this. I will separate myself from the church. And then you're reading and going, but you did do it. Oh no, problems right here. And then he just kept consulting church tradition and church history. And it was actually, I'll just read a little bit, but it was the example of St. Eusebius, who was a bishop of Samosate, which somewhere in the Arian crisis. And at the time of the Arian crisis, when this bishop had returned from exile, he learned that numerous local churches were in need of pastors, so he began to go throughout the area, ordaining priests and deacons and consecrating solely Orthodox bishops without jurisdiction. And he found, and Lefebvre found this in Dom Grea, who was a French founder of something of the Immaculate Heart, so religious brothers and sisters and things. And so he said, so if history shows us bishops who took it on themselves to perform the office of doctor, i.e. fixing same time, what precedent is conduct? basically state of necessity. We have precedent in church history for this. So Lefebvre at that point was convinced that even though it was controversial, there was evidence in church history for the consecration of bishops without jurisdiction to do so. And St. Athanasius did similar things. Now, as far as the negotiations go, they really started to pick up after a certain event in 1986, which you just wrote your book, Faithful Indifference. I'm sure you know which I'm talking about, was the Assisi event. So again, you have to understand the context and you have to look at it and go, okay, if you were a pre-Vatican II raised fella and you were used to Catholicism the old way and you saw the Pope participating in what looked like really serious problems, the optics of it are the Pope is breaking the first commandment. That's what it looks like. Okay, I'm not saying that that's what John Paul II did. I'm just saying, looking back, you go, we thought Pachamama was bad. Well, it seems like there was some precedent, sadly. And I'm not saying this to denigrate John Paul II. I'm just, these are the facts. So Lefebvre was worried that we were in another Arian crisis, basically. And again, people have reiterated that since, and he seems kind of vindicated in a sense. So he went through with it. Now, he had signed an accord with Cardinal Ratzinger on May 5th, 1988. And in there, it was based off of an investigation that was done by a body of priests, some from the society, some established by Rome. So it was sort of a independent body. And they said that the society needs to have a bishop or bishops immediately. So in this accord with Ratzinger, it said, you will have bishops in the near or immediate future. This was on May 5th. Now, this is what Lefebvre says. He says, and you can read this in a book called Archbishop Lefebvre in the Vatican. He says that he went to prayer that night. He was very nervous about signing it because at that point he had already rescheduled consecrations of bishops, which had been implicitly approved twice. And he was getting on in years, and it turned out later that he had a very severe bowel cancer that was developing at the time. And he went to prayer that night and he swears that the Blessed Mother prompted him to say, basically prompted him by saying something like, you're not going to get the consecrations. You have to basically go through with this. That was what that's what Lefebvre says. We have no reason to believe that he was not a faithful man of prayer, so we kind of take him at his word. So the next day he wrote Ratzinger and he said, thank you. Immediate future sounds great. I'll be doing this on June 30th. And he gets a letter back saying, no. You can't do June 30th. You can do August 15th. So if you're a betting man, you've realized you've called someone's bluff and you think, well, this will be the third time you're telling me to reschedule. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me, sort of thing. So he went through with the consecrations. Now, I don't want to bore the audience too much, but if I could, I might.
He went through with them on June 30th.
June 30th.
Okay.
Yes. It was either June 30th or June 29th. Okay, but yeah, yeah,
something. 30th. Okay. But he did not wait for the August 15th date.
No, he did not. Okay. Because he realized, okay, you're basically, his impression was you're kind of just waiting for me to go away. Now I will say this though, people have said, well, he could have waited. They would have given bishops. The thing is, the Fraternal Society of St. Peter, to whom I have no ill will, so I'm not saying that at all, but they have never been given bishops, which kind of goes to the point where he's saying, I don't really think they want to do traditional bishops. Now the Fraternity of St. Peter has always had traditional ordinations and things because certain bishops will do that. I think, Bishop Strickland just did some ordinations with deacons or something. So anyway, he seems like he's been vindicated in a lot of his positions. Problem is, right after Lefebvre did this action with he was his co-son, some very striking claims in this letter. Basically, what Pope John Paul II says, and I'll actually have it quickly here. He says this, and this is called the Apostolic Letter Ecclesia De Afflicta. Which the Holy Father writes on the subject of the act of disobedience. And he says it in the following terms. He says, in itself, this act was one of disobedience to the Roman pontiff in a very grave matter and of supreme importance for the unity of the church, such as is the ordination of bishops, whereby the apostolic succession is sacramentally perpetuated. Classic JP2 language, very smart, but kind of over your head if you're not into it. But then, remarkably, the Holy Father draws a conclusion that doesn't seem to be found in the premises. By the way, this is not my opinion. This is something that we'll put in the show notes. It's a storied canon lawyer, a priest in the church from New Zealand. And the Holy Father continues. He says, hence, such disobedience, which implies in practice a true repudiation of the Roman primacy, constitutes a schismatic act.
I think that clause, I think, is the key point. Is the act of disobedience to the Pope, is it always a repudiation of what do you say? Repudiation
of repudiation of the Roman primacy.
I think that is the key point right there, because I think a lot of Catholics would argue that if the Pope, because the Pope has universal jurisdiction, he does have the authority to, you know, I mean, for example, he could tell a parish priest in Topeka, you're being moved now to a parish in Los Angeles. And that priest, and he's the only one in the church who could do that, because a bishop only has authority in his diocese, and a cardinal doesn't have that type of authority either. But the Pope does have universal jurisdiction. So if that priest said, no, I'm not leaving Topeka, that is clearly an act of disobedience. I mean, I think that's non-controversial. So the question is that a repudiation of the Roman primacy? And by doing that, does that priest enter into schism, which of course now apply to Archbishop Lefebvre? Is like, I totally get, like, I have a hard time thinking that's a repudiation of Roman primacy, because I mean, that just seems to be a leap too far. But at the same time, Roman primacy does include universal jurisdiction. And so if you disobey it, you're at some level, I don't know, not following it, not, I don't know how to put it. I think repudiation is probably too strong, but you're doing something against Roman primacy on some level.
You're disobeying.
You're disobeying, right.
And then again, we have to say, well, in certain situations, is disobedience lawful? It is lawful, hypothetically here.
Right.
Lawful if we're obeying a higher authority. Now, the only higher authority than the Pope would be God.
Correct.
And that's why we see in Acts of the Apostles, even though in Romans it says, obey your superior in all things, we obviously obey superiors in all things lawful, and we obey God over man, as what it says in Acts. But these are very rare situations, which is why some people will say, well, he's the new Luther. No, he's not the new Luther. However, I understand that sentiment where you're going, you got to be really careful with that, because you do have to be really careful with that. Which is why, thankfully, it's only happened a few times in church history by certain saints. St. Eusebius, St. Athanasius, who was excommunicated by Pope Liberius II. There is precedent for these things in very unique circumstances. Now, what's interesting about what John Paul II said, he's talking about Canon 751. And Canon 751 is outlined in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, in paragraph 2081, if I'm not mistaken. And schism is defined essentially as refusal of submission to the Supreme Pontiff and refusal of communion with other members of the church. So here's the thing I want to say to my fellow SSPX agnostic or skeptical folks. If it can be proven that the SSPX is not in schism, which it can be proven that the society is not in schism, there's no problem with that. That's actually never been the case. So even if you believe the things about the four members, the four bishops, well, that doesn't actually include the priests. So you might say that they're wrong on something, but they've actually never been in schism, and the lay faithful have never been in schism unless they themselves personally decide to be schismatic in their heart, and we can't know that. So schism goes vertically and it goes horizontally. If you say, I don't care what the Pope says, screw those guys in the SSPX, that's a schismatic mentality because they're Roman Catholics and you're saying, I don't want anything to do with them. On the other hand, if you say, if you're someone who attends a society and you say, I know the SSPX is not in schism, but I don't want anything to do with those guys over there because they're not as good of a Catholic as I am, that's also a schismatic mentality defined by canon law. So it's refusal of submission to the Pope. Now, and with members of the church. But if you go and you read Canon 751 in the Latin, okay, and I'm not a Latin expert, but I can pretend by looking up things on the internet. And this is, again, from that canon lawyer. And he says the defining word in that canon, 751, is detrectatio, which is meant refusal of all submission. So did Lefebvre refuse all submission of the Pope? Well, clearly not, because he prayed for him in the Mass. So he recognized him as the Pope that he had to pray for in the Mass. That's very implicit. Also, if you you can go read the sermon that he gave and made it very explicit. These are auxiliary bishops. They have no jurisdiction. They are here to ordain priests, to confer the power of orders for the building up the body of Christ and the service of Rome, eternal Rome, you know, the church as a whole. John Paul II put that letter out in July, Sanctic Interpretation of Canon Law, these long titles in the church. And he points out, now you ask yourself, is this guy now in schism? Because he's disobeying, in theory, something the Pope has said, which is a major Italian newspaper's paper, but it's a big one nonetheless in that country. And this is on July 10th. And he's speaking about Lefebvre in this interview. And this man who is in charge of this in the church is not in itself a schismatic act. In fact, the code that deals with offenses is divided into two sections. One with offenses against religion and the unity of the church, and they are apostasy, schism, and heresy. That's Canon 751. And consecrating a bishop without a pontifical mandate is, on the contrary, an offense against the exercise of specific ministry. Basically, what he's saying is, it's not a schismatic act to do what Lefebvre did. But John Paul II, 8 days earlier, says Lefebvre is in schism. So what do you do with that? Yeah. I don't know.
It's a weird, it is definitely an odd situation, because I think you can't, like, comparing it to Luther is silly, because Luther rejected the office of the papacy, which clearly Lefebvre did not do. Likewise, even comparing it to the Orthodox doesn't work, because the Orthodox reject Roman primacy as the Catholic Church understands it. Mm-hmm. And so that is, and most importantly, if you look at the history in the early church, the way that you declared communion between two bodies was by the liturgical act of including them in the prayers of the Mass, of the Divine Liturgy in the East. And
they do that.
SSPX includes Pope Francis in the prayers. Mm-hmm. Like, and local SSPV, the Society of St. Pius V, does not. They do not include Pope Francis' name, as well as the other independent chapels. And I'm of the belief that if you're Sede Vacantinus, you are in schism. I mean, that's, I know that's,
well, I would also add, there are, I know they're just, in fairness, there are some, I've never been to one, but there are some independent chapels where if you go to their website, they say, we are not Sedes, we pray for Pope Francis. So okay. I don't know what that means, but
right.
Some of them are different.
Yeah. I don't want to lump everybody. Yeah. And I don't want to get in the whole Sede argument here, but the point is with the SSPX, they're in a situation where the leader, the founder, Lefebvre, directly disobeys the legitimate pontiff, yet he also recognizes him as the legitimate pontiff, and he recognizes the Catholic conception of what the primacy of the Pope. In fact, he probably recognizes it more than most Catholics do today, in the sense that he really, you know, in fact, I would probably even say he's more hyper papal than he probably should have been, if anything. So And again, the society continues praying for Pope Francis, or JP2, Benedict Francis, in the Mass. Plus, they clearly have relations with the Vatican. Like you mentioned, they get approval from Rome, and Rome writes back to them, correct? I mean, it's not like they're sending letters and they don't get a response.
Yes. And Bishop Fillet is on the, well, he was, I don't know if he still is, but he was on the appellate court of the Roman Rota for disciplinary thing. So they actually recognize his authority. They recognize his authority as a bishop over priests. And I will add something too as well. You see, there's so much with this that's misinformation, which again, Lefebvre is either correct or he's incorrect. I believe he's correct. But if he's correct, it's because we're in a situation of crisis that warrants extraordinary action, as we've seen with certain prelates of the church in history. And that can really only be judged by history. You can look back. I mean, there were probably people at the time who were saying St. Athanasius was a schismatic. There were probably people at the time that were saying St. Joan of Arc was schismatic for not obeying her local ordinary and repudiating these things can only be judged by history. So as far as Lefebvre goes, the two of the canons that they threw at him were Canon 1364, which says an apostate from the faith, a heretic or a schismatic, incurs a penalty of laetae sententiae excommunication, which basically means that he separates himself from the church by the act itself. Well, again, he's not an apostate, definitely. He's definitely not a heretic. So he has to be a schismatic, but he doesn't fit the definition of schism. So therefore, Canon 1364 can't really apply. And this has been acknowledged by many people since then. And again, this is just one of those things that was declared. It's like, we declare. Well, that's great. You know, so you sound like that old Bugs Bunny. I do declare, you know, you that's great, but you have
it's
to
like,
prove
no, it's
it in
like
court.
That Office scene where Michael says, I declare bankruptcy.
I declare bankruptcy. Yeah. But you have to, there's still a court. That's people don't realize. I mean, this is the rule of law that we have in our society mimics what we learn from the church and from Roman society. You have to go through the process. The process never happened. Now, they also threw Canon 1382 at him, and this is the most nerve-wracking one. It really is. And it says, but the bishop who without pontifical mandate consecrates a person, a bishop, and the one who receives a consecration from him will incur laetae sententiae excommunication. You think, okay, that's closed and shut. The problem is that type of offense has to be judged by another canon. I'm paraphrasing here, that no one is liable to a penalty who, this is just classic Catholic moral theology. A mortal sin, for example, is not always a mortal sin in certain circumstances. Obviously, killing somebody is not intrinsically evil if it's in self-defense, but killing somebody willingly. The same thing happens, a person dies, but the intention actually makes a difference whether or not it's sinful. This is just, again, theology 101 for Catholic morals. And these circumstances that apply for Lefebvre specifically are contained in seven subsections of this canon. 4 and 7 are the most relevant. Subsection 4 says, he's exempt from penalty, one who acted by reason of necessity. In the common estimation of a man, necessity arises where there is a crisis. Again, it is subjective, but it can only be judged by the context of the act itself. And subsection 7 exempts one who, through no personal fault, thought that there was a necessity. So here's the thing. Even if Lefebvre was wrong, I think we can say, you and I can agree on this, he was not an imprudent man. He was not he waited until he was almost dead. He really did think the decision through. And then he believed that there was no other recourse from the best that he could know. I believe he was correct, but even if I didn't, I would have to judge him based on these circumstances and say, the law is made by the church to be followed. And if I can do a 10-minute internet search and find these things, it really is sad that so many people calumniate and detract from the good works of the society but to be in an irregular situation in the church, I think a lot of us would find ourselves in irregular situations considering how things are right now.
And I think it really does come down to, I think what you said about history judging it, because if you look at the history of the church, you see lots of people who leave the church because they think they're right. They sincerely believe it. They think God has told them to do this, or whatever. And history has judged, no, you were just a heretic. Yep. You were just a crazy person. You were just whatever. And you just did, and you died out. What's interesting is that, and so you're right. History is going to have to judge whether or not Lefebvre was right or wrong or not. I think it is indisputable he was sincere and that he was sincerely trying to be the best Catholic he could be. Now that's not enough necessarily, to make him right. It just means that that's his intentions. Now, I think one thing you could say is it's now been over 30 years since this has occurred. Mm-hmm. And the society still exists. It still prays for the valid Pope. Mm-hmm. It still works with Rome and Rome. And this is one for me, like, again, I've never gone to the SSPX chapel. I'm clearly sympathetic. I wouldn't have had you on if I wasn't. But for me, the biggest thing is the Vatican itself today. I'm not talking about 1988. I'm talking about the Pope today, the valid Pope today, Pope Francis, and the Pope before him, Pope Benedict. Now, Pope John Paul II, I get the whole, there's personal stuff going on. And I JP2, I'm a big fan of in a lot of ways and not so much a fan in some other ways. But the point is that to put him aside for a second, the Pope we're under right now, Francis, clearly sees the society as a part of the Catholic Church, because he doesn't go around telling the Patriarch of Moscow, the Orthodox Patriarch of Moscow, oh, your priests now have jurisdiction or whatever, because that would be absurd. He doesn't tell a Lutheran pastor, okay, now you can, I don't know, hear confessions or whatever. I mean, do whatever, I don't want to hear what he tells a Lutheran pastor, but the point is the way Francis treats the society is honestly one of the biggest factors for me for being sympathetic to it. Because if Francis, who's clearly ideologically not aligned with the society on a lot of things, I think we all know that's not like some big revelation. you know, only Nixon couldn't go to China. I guess only Francis can make us more receptive to the society, because he treats it like a maybe canonically irregular, but clearly as part of the Catholic Church.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting, though? What you probably know this, but rhetorically here, rhetorical question. Why do we have Summorum Pontificum so that every priest can say the Latin Mass? Because that was actually on behalf of those rad, schismatic-y, trad SSPXers. They said, we will continue these negotiations for perfect reconciliation, which they desire. They desire to, well, they desire Rome to be faithful in the institutional sense. We obviously know in the sort of divine plan, Rome is not losing the faith. That's not what we're saying. They said, please liberate all priests to say the Latin Mass. That was one of their stipulations in 2007. So Summorum Pontificum by Pope Benedict was actually the brainchild of the SSPX. I mean, come on, talk about charity. We want all Catholic priests to say this Mass, which is their birthright, which I think is the name of Peter Kwasniewski's book. And we want all Catholics to go to this and breathe the fresh air of true Catholicism. And then 2009, Benedict officially recognizes that the excommunications have been lifted. Again, these things are legal complexities, because it was never proven that X, Y, and Z applied. But just from broad strokes, it's obvious. It's gone. There's no penalties. And the priests themselves were not under them. And after 1988, he doesn't, in fact, there were people go, because Benedict, he tried really hard to play both sides as best as possible, razor's edge. And a lot of bishops who don't like the society really ticked, because they said, well, that implies Lefebvre had his lifted, because you said the minister's involved, and that includes Lefebvre. Anyway, so at this point, you know, I had a conversation. I've had many conversations with clerics who have had very strange positions about the SSPX. And I sat with one who did not like the fact that I was going to the society, even though he himself was a traditional, well, he's not a traditional priest, but says it's traditional Mass. And I showed him documents on my phone. I said, here, this is from Rome, you know, X, Y, and Z. This is not a problem. And he said to me, well, that is not the position of our diocese. Mm. And I'm thinking, well, isn't that hilarious? I'm apparently the disobedient one. And I'm saying, I'm trying to do what the Pope said. And you're saying, well, I don't care what the Pope said. I care what the bishop said. Sounds like a national church to me. And so at this point, if whatever you think about Lefebvre, like, I have my thoughts. I will say this, though. Even if you don't think he's a saint and was correct, you said it perfectly. You cannot say that he wasn't sincere, and you cannot say that he wasn't pious and loved souls. So maybe he won't be the man that you put on your wall as a picture like I do. But it's not correct, just from the general human respect, to speak about him in ways that are not becoming of what he actually did, without sufficient research. So I think that's something, you know, again, if you want communion to be easily understood, if you want to have better relations with your fellow Catholics, then you got to look at that definition of schism all the way through, which includes the vertical, which you cannot apply to the SSPX. We've gone through that. But it does include the horizontal, which, if we're honest with ourselves, if we're saying the SSPX parishioners can go pound salt, you might be ignorant about it. And that's one thing. But if you're not, then you yourself are, and I'm not blaming anyone, but you yourself may be exhibiting the characteristics that you find reprehensible in the society, but it might actually be projection. So that's, you know, that's something we all have to consider when talking about this.
Right? Okay, I think we're going to wrap it up here. I think one conclusion is, I think clearly church history is messy.
Yes.
There's lots of cases of things that aren't as clear cut as we want them to be. I mean, obviously, somebody like St. John of Arc dies, excommunicates. St. Athanasius lived in a time of just, I mean, I can't even imagine trying to figure, if some canon lawyer tried to figure things out those days, what they would have done. They probably, their head would have exploded. And so there's a lot of messy things. And the fact is that the relationship of the society and the Catholic Church broadly, the Vatican, has been messy at times. But I think, at least my takeaway from it is that the Vatican treats today, in 2021, the Vatican treats the society as part of the church with some canonical issues, yes. And so that's why I feel like Catholics should do that. Because obviously Francis, who, like I said, isn't ideologically aligned with the society in a lot of things, yet treats them as part of his church, you know, as the Pope, then I think we should do the same. Is there any final thoughts you kind of wanted to leave us with, Kennedy, before we go about all this?
Sure. I just want to tell a quick 2-minute heartwarming story.
Oh, great.
During the lockdown, we had no sacraments around here. The bishops around here essentially forbade even confessions. My brother-in-law, and he gave me permission to tell the story. I love this young man to pieces, and he lived away from God for many years in sin, as we all do. At some point, and he had his particular sins, which are his, and we don't need to reveal them, but we were worried about him for a long time. During the lockdown last year, that first 2 weeks, he was in a rough place and had a major conversion by spending time with my wife and my children and I. We were praying a rosary novena, and it's sort of his Catholic sense from his baptism kicked in, and he basically made the decision that, oh my, I need to give my life to God. And he texted us and he said, how do I go to confession? What do I do? Well, if it was not for the Society of St. Pius X, I don't know what would have happened. But that day, I was able to pick him up, drive an hour to pick him up and bring him to confession very quickly. And he spent a half an hour in confession and an hour in spiritual direction and what to do. Lost in a culture to being someone who prays the rosary, attends confession, and loves the Lord with all his heart. And wears a scapular, thank God. And it was the priests of the Society of St. Pius X who decided to obey God over the government and make sure that one more soul would escape the fires of hell.
That's beautiful.
That's all you can do,
Yeah. So I mean that is the you know them by their fruits, and they'll know we are Christians by our love, to use the kind of other phrase. That's love right there, is that that priest, he obviously, who heard his confession, he was probably technically breaking some type of legal Canadian law or some mandate or whatever, but he knew the divine law is what matters more than anything. So that's great. That's a great way to end it too. I love that. So, well, thanks for being on the show, Kennedy. I really appreciate it. For those who are watching, listening, please subscribe, like the video on YouTube if you're watching it there, or in your podcast feed, subscribe so you can get other stuff. And until next time, we'll see you then.